from Washington. This is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, where do post-election U.S.-Egyptian relations stand? Reaction to Obama's road for U.S. foreign policy. The Tiananmen crackdown casts a long shadow over China's press. And the African Union starts a campaign to reduce child marriage.
Make sure they go and take that child out of marriage and put her back into school.
It's all ahead. I'm Susan Yalke. Former Egyptian Army Chief Abdel Fattah el-Sisi has won a landslide victory in his presidential bid against rival Hamdine Sabahi. Preliminary results from the three-day vote, which ended Wednesday, give Sisi more than 93% of the ballots cast. Sabahi, who received just 3%, conceded defeat, saying he would accept the will of the people. Sisi was all but assured of victory ahead of polls, but had called for a turnout large enough to give him a broad mandate to fix the economy and end the country's political turmoil. Officials say about 46% of Egypt's 54 million eligible voters participated in the poll. That's less than 52% turnout secured during the 2012 election of Mohamed Morsi. Amy Hawthorne is a senior fellow at the Atlantic Council's Rafiq Hariri Center for the Middle East and a former U.S. State Department official on Egypt. VOA's Mohamed El-Shenawy asked her about U.S. policy options in a post-election Egypt.
Sisi, in his recent remarks about relations with the United States, I think has emphasized two themes. The first is rather, maybe not friendly, but conciliatory tone toward the United States, stressing the importance of good relations, the importance of the U.S.-Egyptian strategic relationship, and his desire to continue that. On the other hand, however, his remarks have indicated that he wants the relationship with the United States to be on Egypt's terms, his terms, which I think basically means that the U.S. will accept his narrative of Egypt's political trajectory, his definition of terrorism, and his approach to governing. So if the U.S. Comes around to see things his way, then I think he's indicating the relationship could be stronger and could get back on solid footing. I, however, don't think that the U.S. will be coming around to that view anytime soon, and that's why I think a lot of tension will remain in the U.S.-Egypt relationship even after he is elected.
Following President Obama's latest remarks on Egypt, does the U.S. have different policy options in post-election Egypt?
The United States, in my view, the most important strategic approach that the United States could make toward Egypt in the coming period is to try to build a relationship with Egypt, with a country, not just with one person, whoever is ruling the country at the time. We have seen that while there is a lot of support for Sisi in Egypt, there are also a lot of Egyptians who have a different view or who aren't as enthusiastic about his rule as others. Egypt is a country of diverse opinions and pluralism. And the United States, in my view, can best protect its strategic interests over the long term if we recognize this diversity and try to build stronger relations with Egyptians and the Egyptian people, not just cooperate closely with the government, which, of course, the U.S. will continue to do. I am not sure that that is the approach that the Obama administration wants to take, but in my view, that would be really in the U.S. Best interest over the longer term.
Amy Hawthorne, senior fellow at the Atlantic Council's Rafiq Hariri Center for the Middle East. As we reported Wednesday, U.S. President Barack Obama says that American isolationism is not an option, but not every problem has a military solution. Mr. Obama used his commencement address at the U.S. Military Academy to present his foreign policy vision for his final years in office. He said terrorism remains the most direct threat to American security, and he called for partnering with countries where terrorist networks seek a foothold. He stressed that the United States should never ask permission to protect its people or its homeland, but when issues of global concern are at stake that do not pose a direct threat to the United States, then the threshold for military action must be higher. Jonathan Edelman, associate professor at the University of Denver's Corbell School of International Studies, tells VOA's Victor Beatty the speech was defensive in tone and was a response to growing bipartisan criticism of his perceived foreign policy indecisiveness.
He's in his sixth year. And if you look at previous presidents in their second term, they've often wound up in exactly the same position of being defensive, of trying to explain why they think the way they do. But the critics, by the way, are not just anymore in the Republican Party. There's quite a lot of criticism coming from the Democratic Party, and you can read that even in some of the things Hillary Clinton is saying as well. So I think this was his response to all of that.
The president focused on terrorism. He announced a $5 billion proposal to serve as a partnership fund to help countries fight terrorism on their soil.
We definitely need to do it. Now, today, we're not just dealing anymore with Osama bin Laden in Afghanistan. We're dealing in Yemen. We're dealing in Nigeria. You know, we're dealing throughout the Middle East. So I think what he's doing is absolutely correct. We need to be really helpful because a lot of these countries just can't manage on their own without some serious external help.
Well, what would this help look like?
It's not going to be soldiers on the ground. It's not even going to be CIA special forces on the ground. But what it's going to be is fundamentally training and the security forces for those individual countries in the best tactics to allow them to be able to work together with us on drones, to be able to identify who the enemy is, perhaps to make them much more professional, because that's the core problem, that in many of these countries, their forces are not very professional and not very well paid. And so we want to move it up a couple notches so that they'll have a better chance against the terrorists.
He also vowed to ramp up support for the Syrian opposition. Is it a little late for that?
Yeah, I'm afraid it's 3 years too late, and that's being heard a lot these days. I mean, I think 3 years ago, when this started, people gave Bashar 6 months, a year at most. But now that we see ISIS and al-Nusra are, you know, gaining, the al-Qaeda affiliates are gaining so much influence, there is a feeling that it is too little too late for the secular Democrats. And I feel sorry for them because the fight that they wanted to take to Bashar Assad was something that most Americans would probably agree with. But I think now, 3 years later, it's just too little. I mean, the United States still isn't providing the two things that the rebels need, which are anti-tank weapons and especially anti-aircraft against the principal advantages that Bashar Assad has in airplanes and in tanks.
What did you make of the overall direction of the speech? Was it a coherent foreign policy statement?
Yes and no. Whenever you make a speech, inevitably it simplifies and sometimes overly simplifies. But I think it's not really between what the president would have us believe, between diplomacy and war. If you look at Iran, we need to do both. We need to ramp up the sanctions, which now have gone too easy. But we need to regain, after the debacle in Syria and in Libya for the United States, we need to regain the feeling in the Middle East that we are, as Osama bin Laden himself said, the strong horse in the Middle East. Only a combination of credible military threat to the Iranians and diplomacy accompanied with serious sanctions if they don't provide what we in the world want is going to work. It's not one or the other. We need both.
Mr. Obama said regional aggression that goes unchecked, whether in southern Ukraine or the South China Sea, could draw in our military. He also expressed support for efforts by Southeast Asian nations to negotiate a code of conduct with China in their maritime disputes. But he made no reference in his West Point remarks to his administration's rebalance toward the Asia-Pacific region. That, says Brad Glosserman of the Hawaii-based security think tank Pacific Forum, was a mistake. Or so is Mr. Obama's emphasis on terrorism as America's foremost national security threat.
To argue that terrorism is the chief problem, I think, in our time is a mistake. Terrorism has been and will continue to be a problem, but I do not believe that it deserves to be front and center on U.S. strategy. Clearly, the larger issue of American power and influence in the world particularly in Asia, is important. And frankly, they're going to be, and this is always controversial, that there are going to be many security problems for which the U.S. military will only be a palliative. You know, and by this, I'm talking, of course, about questions like climate change. These are seen by military and strategic planners as critical questions, and one in which the U.S. military is forced to play a role but is not leading and is not the answer.
With the lack of focus on Asia-Pacific, what do you think the reaction in Asia-Pacific will be?
It will be concern insofar as the message that the administration has been trying to deliver. Unfortunately, I'm afraid to say, in an inconsistent manner, the message is that the United States is committed that the rebalance is not just a passing fancy, and that it is an enduring American commitment, and that it will be funded and seen as such by the United States and by its allies, partners, and yes, even its adversaries. All parties are going to be wondering, when he downplays the emphasis on the military, that's consistent with one message, but unfortunately, and I would say regretfully, certainly for me, this is not what the Asians want to hear. This is an interesting paradox for the president. The key component of his, as he puts it, is this notion that the military is not the answer to all problems. And I think an attempt to convince Asian audiences that the Americans and that this country is committed to engagement with that region and in other ways, and in not, and if you will, not undermining, but rebalancing the role of the military in the form of our engagement, does in no way reflect the diminution of the U.S. commitment to defend and secure the peace in Asia. Yet this is not what those countries, I think, want to hear. It's certainly a difficult message to deliver at West Point. You don't tell the cadets that their role is going to be less important, or that their commitment needs to flag any. And so it's a very difficult line to walk, to respond to different audiences and to send all these very complex messages.
Glasserman says for the sake of a strong U.S. economy, the rebalance toward Asia must remain a key part of U.S. foreign policy.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's voanews.com. Online news for a changing world.
It has been 25 years since the Tiananmen massacre, and while the memory of the government's bloody crackdown on protesters is alive in the minds of many, the anniversary is likely to go unnoticed in Chinese media. The media blackout is a strong reminder of how 25 years after the events of the spring of 1989, China's leaders have yet to respond to one of the protesters' key demands, the call for press freedom. Rebecca Valley reports from Hong Kong.
During the 1989 protests, when journalists joined the students in the streets, one of the slogans they displayed on banners was "Don't force us to tell lies." A spontaneous gathering to commemorate the death of Hu Yaobang, a reformist leader, evolved into a broader call for political participation and freedom of expression. As sit-ins around Tiananmen Square continued for weeks, some publications that were supported by reform-minded leaders covered the events with significant independence. Hong Kong-based journalist Liu Reixiao was reporting on the students' movement from Beijing for a Hong Kong newspaper. He says that the leadership itself had planted the seed for more accurate news reporting at a party congress in 1987. He says leaders had made statements saying that people should be informed and discuss about important events. The environment was more open, he says, and people in the media circles were very active. That relatively free media environment began to be curbed when Beijing imposed martial law on May 20. Then the violent crackdown on protesters on June 4th showed that the hardline within the Communist Party had prevailed. Leaders who had spoken in favor of media reform were marginalized, and a draft law intended to make media more open was shelved. China's leaders then used state-controlled media to amplify their message denouncing the democratic movement. Many journalists who had sided with the students were jailed or suspended. Chang Ping, a well-known journalist ostracized in China for his bold editorials on sensitive issues, says that by 1989, the leadership decided that media freedom was a liability. The Communist Party came to a conclusion after Tiananmen, he says. Not having properly controlled the media was a huge lesson for them. The lesson came from the events in Tiananmen, from the Soviet Union collapse, and the changes in Eastern Europe. So, he says, after Tiananmen, controlling the media became a top priority. 25 years later, China is now the world's biggest market for newspapers and internet users, both of which are closely regulated by authorities. Despite the constant policing of content deemed sensitive, the internet remains a major force for spreading information and exchanging ideas. Internet users routinely use the medium to discuss sensitive political ideas, shame officials accused of corruption, or post videos of lawbreakers. While some of the work of journalists and citizen bloggers leads to party and police investigations, reporters still face big risks when using the internet to distribute their findings or comment on sensitive topics. Authorities recently charged journalist Gao Yu with divulging state secrets after she shared the contents of an internal party policy paper with foreign media organizations. Qing Chong, a senior Hong Kong journalist, faced the same charge in 2005 and was imprisoned for almost 3 years. He says there used to be hope among intellectuals and the public that the internet would be a catalyst for freedom.
Clearly, this is not going to happen because you know why? Chinese President Xi Jinping has just ordered the setup of a national commission to monitor cybersecurity, and he also mentioned last year in his August 19 speech that the internet has become a source of threat to national security.
After that speech, authorities launched a campaign to punish rumor mongering online, criminally charging bloggers for posting content deemed sensitive. Despite the crackdown, journalists are still defying state censorship. And despite years of censorship, Hong Kong journalist Lui Rei Shao says the public still clamors for unfiltered information and open debate. The policies on media freedom have not changed in the past 25 years, he says. But what has changed are the increasing aspiration for media freedom from common people, staff in the media industry, intellectuals and students. Common people and journalists are not leaving propaganda officials with the monopoly on news. Still, this year's Tiananmen anniversary is likely to go unnoticed on Chinese media. While in the last decades journalists have gained more leeway to cover social and political events, June 4th is still a taboo topic. Authorities already have warned foreign journalists against reporting from Tiananmen Square. Rebecca Valley reporting for VOA News Hong Kong.
One of Cambodia's most prominent advocacy figures has resigned following media reports that she fabricated her own life story and the stories of several other women who claimed to be sex trafficking victims. Somali Mam, who founded the Anti-Sex Trafficking Foundation that bears her name, resigned this week following an internal investigation. Robert Carmichael reports from Phnom Penh.
Somali Mam has for years been a leading figure internationally in efforts to combat sex trafficking. In 2009, the US-based news publication Time magazine named her one of the world's 100 most influential people. 3 years earlier, the cable news channel CNN listed her as one of its heroes. Her eponymous non-profit, the Somali Mam Foundation, is based in New York and raises money for her Cambodia-based organization, AFASIP. That in turn operates three centers for victims of sex trafficking. The Somali Mam Foundation has long been a favorite with American celebrities. Among its trustees are Hollywood actress Susan Sarandon and Facebook's chief operating officer, Sheryl Sandberg. But over the past 2 years, a series of media reports raised doubts about the stories told by some of the women her foundation put forward as sex trafficking victims. More recently, questions were asked about some of the truths behind Somali Mam's own well-publicized story as a victim of sex trafficking. The reports initially ran in 2012 and 2013 in the Cambodia Daily, an English-language newspaper. But it was not until earlier this year that the Somali Mam Foundation appointed a law firm to examine the claims. Earlier this month, the US-based magazine Newsweek ran a cover story by former Cambodia Daily editor Simon Marks that presented many of the same allegations to a much wider audience. On Wednesday in New York, the foundation's executive director, Gina Rice Wilkins, announced that, as a consequence of the investigation's findings, Somali Mam had resigned. Rice Wilkins also announced that Long Pros, whose story as a child sex slave who had survived extraordinary brutality appeared in the New York Times, would no longer have any affiliation with the foundation. Somali Mam has not commented publicly on the allegations or on her resignation. In an email, Alison Nakamura, the foundation's senior director of communications, told VOA that the organization would not say anything more at this time. The foundation has not released the results of its investigation. Yet the fallout from the investigation could have wider implications than Somali Mam and her two non-governmental organizations. Sebastian Marrow is the founder of Friends International, a highly regarded organization that works in Cambodia and abroad with thousands of street children. He says his concern is that today's news could hurt other organizations working in the anti-trafficking sector.
Well, my biggest worry as a consequence from all this is that it will give and could give a really bad image of the work done in Cambodia and the work done in the field of trafficking and women at risk. And it would be very, very damaging to, it could become very damaging to NGOs in Cambodia and elsewhere, and really undermine the good work carried out by also many of these organizations.
The Somali Mam Foundation was established in 2007 to combat the trafficking and sexual exploitation of women and girls in Southeast Asia, and has since then raised the profile of the issue. But over the years, some of the claims made by Somali Mam raised eyebrows, as did the organization's use of alleged victims of sex trafficking to raise awareness and funds. Its decision to allow New York Times journalist Nicholas Kristof to live tweet a brothel raid in Cambodia in 2011 was also sharply criticized. Robert Carmichael for VOA News, Phnom Penh.
In a majority of African countries, at least 30% of girls are married before the age 18, often against their will. Martha Vanderwolf reports from Addis Ababa. The raid has led the African Union to launch a two-year campaign to end child marriage in Africa.
14 million girls below the age of 18 are forced into marriage each year by their parents in developing countries. Most of these countries are in Africa. Zanabu is a 16-year-old girl from Niger. She says that she was taken out of school by her parents to get married, but her husband would beat her if she didn't want him to touch her. She ran away to her parents, but they would also beat her and return her to the husband. She says she eventually ran away to an aunt and wants to go back to school. Girls married at a young age often have mental anguish, suffer health problems due to early pregnancies, and are less likely to get an education. Most of them come from poorly educated families and rural areas where girls cannot oppose the cultural norms of the family and community. The African Union campaign to end child marriage is focused on policy action and raising continental awareness. The director of the AU Social Affairs Commission, Olawe Megun, says member states of the AU should follow and implement legal frameworks that protect children.
The Charter on the Rights of the Child, for example, has clear provisions on harmful practices against the child. And it's clear in the provisions of the Charter, culture or religious or whatever should not be an excuse, and the states must take measures to eliminate them. People use all sorts of excuses to perpetuate what they're doing, but it's not an excuse as far as the Commission is concerned.
Among African countries, child marriage rates are highest in Niger and Chad, with rates above 70%. In Zambia, the rate is 42%. 10 government ministries, including health, education, and legal affairs, are working together to bring that rate down. Zambian Minister of Chiefs and Traditional Affairs, Nkandu Luyo, says traditional chiefs are also trying to change the cultural norm about child marriage in the country.
The reason we felt that the chiefs should be the ones is because it hinges on customary law, and there's also a belief that it is to do with our cultures. When any parent is reported to the chief, first of all, they appear before the chief, because there's the traditional court. So they appear before the traditional court and they are charged according to the decision by the traditional court. But they also make sure they go and take that child out of marriage and put her back into school.
The End Child Marriage campaign of the AU is done in cooperation with African governments, UNICEF, and civil society organizations. Marta van der Wolf for VOA News, Addis Ababa.
Thank you for joining us today for International Edition. You can get the latest breaking news and analysis on global events 24 hours a day on our website at voanews.com. That's voanews.com. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington.